Today we want to focus on the topic intimacy, confrontation, and commitment. We've been talking with some around the village and have found people on staff and in other ways raising the question of the man-woman relationship today. What's happening to it? How do you make it? Many people that I talk to are wondering, how do you make it in marriage with our friends often splitting? Often those couples that we think are most secure in their marriage, all of a sudden, bango, they decide to split. And so it's scary. And many are wondering, you know, what can we do? How does it happen? What's all of this about? Have you wondered how it is that two people who can be oftentimes living close together, working, eating, sleeping, playing together, can become strangers, can end up not knowing each other, and can end up, in a sense, miles apart? How is it that two people can be very close, even sexually close, and yet not have a sense of really being with each other? That for me raises the question of the first part of this topic, and that's the question of intimacy. What is intimacy? And how do we move towards that? One of the titles I was thinking of as I was thinking about this was a title coming from Henry Nouwen, where he says, from loneliness to solitude, which is one of his themes. Or I might say, from loneliness to intimacy. And how to move then from loneliness to solitude. What he talks about is that when we are with ourselves and have the feeling like we're with no one, like we're in a scary place, like there's nothing there, even though we're there. That's what he talks about as loneliness. That we don't have a sense of ourselves that gives us a feeling of being with someone when we're alone with ourselves. And he talks about it then in terms of discovering how to have a deep sense of self, how to have the kind of faith that helps us discover that we are a somebody in that moment when we're doing nothing. We are somebody by the grace of God. And that we can accept ourselves and be with ourselves and discover ourselves in that moment that he calls solitude. And when we have that kind of relationship, being alone can be an unfolding discovery of who we are and can have then all the adventure of solitude rather than the emptiness of loneliness. Well, I think some of the same images apply to intimacy, being with someone. If we have little sense of who we are, and if in the moment we are trying to get the other person to make us feel like we are somebody, then we have a deep aching need. Won't you, another human being, make me really feel like I'm important, like I'm really somebody? And often what happens in that moment is that no matter what the other person does, it never seems to be enough. If they say nice things to you, you begin to doubt them. If they do nice things for you, they don't do the right things, or they don't do enough. And often we end up feeling like they just don't meet my need. They don't make me feel like somebody. And often what happens then, and this happens in marriage, is that we find someone and we think, oh boy, if this person really loves me, then I'm going to feel great. And we want to marry that person and live life with them. And what happens then is, as we go on, often the way they respond to us and their interest in us isn't enough. because we haven't come to our own sense of identity, and it's like an insatiable pit to fill. And after a while, we begin to say, whatever you're doing or saying isn't enough, therefore you don't really love me, and then we begin to say, and I don't really love you. And then what tends to happen is people begin to look for their source of identity outside of the relationship. And sometimes people find it in work. The success of work. If I succeed at this, then I'll really be somebody. Or find it in the acquiring of possessions. If I have a beautiful house or so much money or power or position or so forth. We begin to try to meet that need in different ways and turn less and less to our partner for a relationship. And then what sometimes happens, and especially nowadays, when we have a circumstance where men and women can meet each other so much more easily than ever in the past, we meet another person of the opposite sex that seems to be able to meet that ache in us, that need in us, and we say, oh, wow, fantastic, this person, I can really love this person. I can't really love the one I've been living with. And so we go chasing that feeling of maybe someone else can make me really feel like somebody. Whereas finally, the only real source of somebodyness is the grace of God. Because that's the only source that lasts, that's the only source that fills us most deeply. And in that, even, finally, it is a decision. It's the decision of faith, it's the decision of acceptance, it's the decision of belief. I am somebody by the grace of God. I will believe that no matter what. I will live with that deep sense of being somebody. Then we become free to move into a relationship and see that the other person is important, is a somebody by the grace of God. We can value them as a person no matter what they do. Then our relationship is based on two people of worth and of value deciding to share life in some way. If we don't do that, what we end up doing is having expectations of the other person that they don't live up to. I wish you would do this, you should have done that, and you don't. And often in those times then, we feel out of sync with each other. Now, what then is intimacy? It is being able to be with someone where you can accept yourself for who you are and you can accept the other person for who they are and you can be open with each other about who you are. And you can permit by that openness an ongoing discovery. And what I mean by that is that when you stop and think about it, God has made each person a fantastically unique creation. And one can spend a whole lifetime discovering another person in the same way you can spend a whole lifetime discovering yourself. So being together with another person can be an ongoing adventure when we begin to really look at what is possible. What happens, however, is that as we begin to have expectations of each other, we begin to see each other in the same way. Oh, I know who she is. She does this, she does that. If I do this, I can expect her to do that. She thinks this way. And we begin to make assumptions about the other person. And we relate then to the assumptions or the mask that we have rather than to where the person actually is. So we really stop listening. We stop looking. We stop letting ourselves experience the person that is with us. We begin to relate to the mask that we have created for the person that we're with. And that can get pretty boring. And we finally kind of lose some of that excitement of discovery and adventure. So, acceptance, openness, and a third quality of intimacy is spontaneity. When you can be who you are with a person and trust that they're going to accept you, you can begin to be spontaneous. You won't need to calculate. Let's see, am I going to say the right thing? Am I going to do it all right? Am I going to be everything this person is expecting me to be? And that then leads to kind of an aliveness, a sense of energy, a freedom to explore, to be, to act, to interact. And that, what I sense, is the potential of intimacy. Now let's explore what some of the dimensions of intimacy might be. I like to do things experientially, and we can experiment with some things here, if you are willing, that may help us have a sense of what intimacy might be like, or at least some of the dimensions of intimacy. So what I'd like to have you do, and this may seem very strange to you, but it's kind of an experiment, so you might see what happens. What I'd like to have you do is find a partner who is someone you don't know well. And we're going to have to push the chairs back some, but find a way to stand and face that partner and decide who's going to be A and who's going to be B. And then I'll give you the next instructions after you're ready. Okay? Okay, everyone stand. Please stand up. Anyone need a partner? Raise your hand if you're looking for a partner. We have anybody that's still looking? Okay, there's someone back there. And anyone else looking for a partner? Okay, the nature of this is you'll have to be paired off to do it. So maybe you'll have to just watch for a moment. And you also need to be standing to do it. Okay, now, what I'd like to have you do is face your partner and put your hands together like this. And for the next few minutes, do not talk, but just begin to move your hands. And just do what you want to with your hands. Yeah, and interact with each other. Okay, just be quiet and get acquainted with your partner with your hands. Kind of talk to each other. Okay, and now bring it to a close and take a moment now to talk with your partner about what it was like at the beginning when there was no definition of leader, and then what was it like as you led and the other person followed? Did you feel like they were following your lead? And then when you switched, what happened? And then in the last part. In other words, what was it like being with this person? Did you feel they were tuned into you? And did you feel like you were tuned into them? Okay?
Okay, just the touch. So you might have had different interests. Did your partner also want to stay with the hands, or would your partner want to move?
Oh, we moved. It's just the feeling of it.
Okay. What do you see this saying about intimacy, being with someone?
We're going to be self-conscious when we leave here.
That'll be real low.
Speak for yourself.
We have thought that it was really kind of contrary to the way we're brought up in society. We just don't automatically just touch a woman next to you. Like, I would never go or reach and touch her. And then to be forced to touch hands and do things with our hands is very, very difficult for both of us.
Okay.
Especially when we notice when you got too close to the person. You stay very...
No man's land.
That's because you don't really know what the distance is, but the person would kind of bypass your opinion back to the middle again.
Very uncomfortable to get like this or this or this. You want to get right in between. Mm-hmm.
Well, it kind of makes your arms tired.
Yes.
Well, another question I thought was difficult was if you really open up wide open like that and kind of lay it, you feel more susceptible. And it was more comfortable to keep it here sort of like this or like this. But once you did this, because you're too open.
Yeah, a little vulnerable then.
Yes.
Well, I felt that, and so did I think my partner, that it was easy when one was leading and the other one accepted it. But the minute you started to alternate the lead, then it was difficult when to adjust to allow the other one to lead. As though, well, how much should I lead and how much should he lead? And I think that goes along with relationships with each other too.
Mm-hmm.
From that viewpoint.
Yes, not knowing when to take
not
the lead.
Not knowing when to let the other partner take over, mm-hmm. or how much to take over.
Okay, now, a number of things. We have different kind of beats or rhythms. Some of you may have wanted to move a lot, and others may have wanted to go very slow, and you had to negotiate that and work out that kind of a difference. Now, if you're thinking only of what's the right way to do this, well, last time I saw somebody do it this way, so I'm going to do it this way. If you're thinking about doing it right, are you going to be able to have any sense of what's going on in the other person? So one of the things that gets in the way of a close relationship is when we think there's a right way to do it and we're going to do it that way. Because then we don't tune in. We're not letting our sensors pick up where the other person is at. Then the ability to move your awareness. Let's see, what would I like to do? Oh, okay, now let me see. Let me move over and tune into the other person. Where's the other person? What do they want? That often we forget that we can move our awareness from on ourselves to the other person and back into ourselves. And that also then is something that kind of skill can help build a way of relating. Again, if some people are totally on the other person, what does the other person want to do now? You know, how do they want to do it? And they keep their awareness totally on themselves and never tune into themselves and say, what do I want?
Totally on the other person.
Or totally on the other person, so they don't share what they want. And when you're relating to that kind of person, it's hard to know sometimes what to do or where the other person is at, what they want. They don't give you any clues. And vice versa. Okay, so this then is an important quality that when... One is when we try to do it right, we get into trouble, and the other is if we don't move our awareness back and forth and tune into each other. And third, when we don't, in a sense, pass the leadership or let the other take the lead and pass it back and forth, we often have difficulties, or we end up in routine ways of doing things. And then that often gets boring. Okay, another aspect of just the way in which we experience a person is how we see them. And I'd like to just for a moment share with you a way of looking that can have some flexibility in it. So would you get with your partner that you have again? You've gotten a little acquainted. We'll get a little more acquainted. Now look at each other and try to figure out the other person, what that other person's like. No talking, just look, just look. Look at the other person and try to figure that other person out. Okay, now close your eyes. Have a good full breath of air and let go of any tension that you have. And have the sense that as you are with this person, that there is nothing that you need to do. That you can just relax and be where you're at. And Now, very slowly, begin to open your eyes. And as you do, let yourself receive the image of the other person, but keep your eyes unfocused and soft. Just let your eyes be very soft and unfocused, and let the image of the person in, just in the sense of receiving that person. And know that there's nothing that you need to do. Okay, begin to open your eyes and receive the other person. Let your eyes be soft and unfocused. You can see the whole room. You can see the whole room and you can see the person. Have the sense that there's nothing that you need to do. You can just relax and receive. And have the sense of giving thanks to God for that person. See in them a unique creation of God. But just accept the whole person, unfocusing your eyes, soft eyes. Okay, again, share with your partner what it was you experienced in those two different ways of looking. What were some of the differences you noted? More relaxed. Okay.
Pretty uncomfortable to stare right in someone's eyes and try to figure out what they are. Okay. I mean, I felt a lot better just being able to see this is a neat person, and I don't know anything about her, but you know, I can pretty much accept her and like her anyway. But it was really, really uncomfortable staring right at her. I mean, it wasn't bad, right?
Right. The scrutiny of looking at. Now, one of the differences between the two, and there's a lot of differences in the way you hear me and the way you experience the exercise, so it may have gotten at this and it may not have for you. But that we have two ways of looking. One is a looking at to figure something out in which we inspect something. And the problem with that is that we often find what we're looking for. That we have certain ideas in our head of what it is we're looking for, and we only look for certain things, so we only see certain things. And this, again, is what happens often in relationship, is we assume that certain things are there, and so we only see those things when we look at the person. We don't see the person. And so the idea here was then to take a look at another way of looking, where you just let in what's there, and don't look for or look at or focus on a particular thing. And then just receive in. And often we receive then in a person in a more holistic sense, a fuller sense. Some have reported that they feel like they get to know the person in a very deep way with this kind of looking. Now we did it very briefly, but you can get to know a person in a way, actually. If you were to do this for 15, 20 minutes. Just sit and look and take that person in. And they're telling you all kinds of things by how they appear and what they're doing. So, if you're in a significant close relationship, keep looking again. Let the person in. Open up your eyes. Begin to see them in all their uniqueness, in all their mystery, and all their beauty. Be careful of the trap of assuming that you know what's there.
Okay, now that you've got somebody that you know and are continuing to discover, I'm going to talk a little bit about conflict. Whenever you are in a close relationship, whether it's two roommates, whether it's you know, in college, whether it's in a marriage situation, whenever you have people living together, you're going to have conflict because they don't always agree on the way they're going to have to move their lives together. I was interested in John's Bible study this morning talking about the Hebrew sense of corporateness. Now, those of you who came in this afternoon, listen to the tape. It's a really good, really excellent Bible study this morning. Will be the base for further things that he talks about this week and that others will talk about this week. But the sense of being part of a unity. And I think I'm going to push that a little bit in the sense, talking here about a marriage, where you have a sense of corporateness. It is an I am part of the marriage, you are part of the marriage, but we together form a unity. And so when we come into conflict, What are ways that we, what do we need to know about those things that we don't agree on? We need to have a sense of communication, otherwise you can only guess what I'm upset about or don't agree with or something like that. We need to deal with not only the issue, but our feelings about the issue and our feelings about sharing that. We, if we have a sense of a corporate sense of being in this together, then hey, how do we resolve this conflict for the good of both of us, for the good of the marriage, you know, or the family as children are added to it? How do we have a sense of a within the body of the marriage, of the family, whatever, how do we come to some resolution that would be satisfactory and would be to the best interest of all concerned? And that's easy to talk about when it's not an emotionally charged situation. But I think that when you have some sense of that to begin with, that it's often easier to deal with the conflict. That, hey, I know that out of this issue, out of working to resolve this issue, we are both going to be trying to resolve it for the best of the marriage, or for both of us, or for the family. In that sense, trust one another's intentions. I guess when Dale and I have had arguments or issues, and we haven't had a lot, we do an awful lot of conflict resolution. Fortunately, we learned some of these things early in the marriage. But it's a sense of, I do trust that he is going to be looking out not only for his interests, but also for mine, and I try to go into it with the same sense that as we enter into some kind of problem-solving, conflict resolution, we're both coming at it from that angle. There are, as I said, there's bound to be conflicts in any kind of close relationship. And there are some rules that some people have designed that says, hey, if you can go at it this way in kind of a dispassionate way, you can move toward some resolution. Maybe it appeals to me because I'm Northern European and, you know, relatively dispassionate. Maybe if I were Italian or Spanish or something, that way I would say, forget about it. There are other ways to solve things. But I guess I have found among many couples that it does help to have a process to go through when you come up to a conflict.
You may want to say something first, though, about when one feels overwhelmed with passion or feeling or emotion.
You want to move with that?
Well, that at the time to deal with an issue, if you're, you know, just loaded with emotion, anger, or feeling, you may need to let off some of that feeling before you're ready to sit down to a really rational process of figuring out the problem. And I like George Bach's emphasis on having two different kinds of rituals for dealing with that. Because if you start trying to work out a solution while you're feeling pretty soon it escalates. One thing doesn't go right in the process, and boy, you're ready to go at each other. So he says, have a ritual or a way to have what he calls a Vesuvius.
That's the Italian method.
Yes, and what he's driving at there is that when you feel just very strongly about something, say, I need to blow up for a minute. I am just so mad. Boy, you know, I'm just boiling inside about this. And let that stuff off. And in a sense, you let the other person know that you need to vent. Hey, okay, I need to have a Vesuvius. I need to blow up for a minute. I need to get this off my chest. And then the other person can know that for that period of time, they don't have to do anything. That they can let you blow. You know, go ahead, blow.
The way you describe that blowing, it's fairly, the object of the blowing is fairly anonymous. And my experience is that the object of your blowing is rather more specific, and that it's very difficult to sit by and either direct your anger at another or to sit by and allow them to direct it at you.
Okay.
Because you're more than just, it's more than just an internal process, but you're also definitely expressing something to another.
Okay, and so when I own, a couple of things there, when I own that it's my anger,
right.
That Ricky didn't make me angry. She did something I didn't like. But I'm choosing to be angry. She can't make me get angry. I'm choosing to be angry. So what I may be saying is, when you do that, I get so mad, I just want to bust the wall. And I can talk about it in that way and deal with the emotion of it. And I can say, when you do this and this and this, I get very angry. And again, see how I keep owning it's my anger that I'm exploding with. And it's what's happening with me. The danger, and you're bringing out a good point, the danger is if I turn that anger on her and say, you so-and-so, you made me so mad by what you did, you know.
You always.
You always
do
that.
You never.
You never do that. And you can't do anything right, and you're just a nincompoop or whatever. Okay, what happens then is that it has moved from anger to hostility. It has become the need to cut her down. And I start hitting below the belt. And when I start hitting below the belt, then it's going to go nowheres. Because then she's going to have to probably respond coming out of feeling like she's really under attack. If I can stay in the issue and identify the issue and explode and get that off our chest, then maybe we can let that go and then we can move to saying, okay, now we have a problem. I have a problem. And we can begin to deal with it.
I think the way we've been trained, you know, a good old traditional culture and sort of thing in North America, Northern European heritage probably, men have had a lot of permission to be angry and to attack. It's been a hostility kind of thing. Women, for the most part, and I'm talking my generation, older, and some kind of in between the younger and mine, have been trained, you know, to swallow it. We aren't supposed to be angry. I mean, if I slammed a door in our house when I was, you know, I felt I had a right to be angry. If I slammed it, I got it again. So I learned to swallow it. And for me, I have had to learn to express my anger. Otherwise, Dale didn't know what was happening because I'd sulk. It was okay in my family for me to be hurt or to sulk, but it wasn't okay to slam a door or to speak harsh words. So in order to communicate what was happening for me, I've had to learn to verbalize it. The same way Dale has learned to own his own anger rather than load it on me.
And for me, this has been extremely helpful. With my kids, I find, hey, there was somebody I could be angry with. I guess they were a little older than I was. And I, you know, they had messed up and I was really tearing to them. So finally my oldest said, and it was a you, this, that, and everything. My oldest started running out to the treehouse. My mother would get angry. And I thought, I don't really want to set up this retreat situation, but he was feeling so overpowered. When I finally learned to own my own anger and verbalize it in terms of when I clean the house and I have everything all ready and then you go down and dump all the Lego. I don't know if you did have people put Lego in all over. I love it. Great toy, but it's messy. Then I feel like, and I would tell them how I felt. I wasn't saying, you made me this way. It was when you've done this, then I feel as though you don't value what I've done, that I feel as though you don't think that I have any value, that the work I've done doesn't count, that it doesn't make any difference. And I, when he started sitting around to do that, then I knew that I wasn't really kind of cutting away off from him. And since that time, there's been a lot better sense of communication. The kids know what I get into about. They know the kinds of actions, and they know it's my own anger. They also know that some days that's okay, and some days that's not. You know, if I've got company coming tonight and I sit and polish the house, then they dump the Lego. That's a lot of a different situation than, you know, just a calm Sunday afternoon, they'll be, they take it over, and they dump the Lego, and then they go on and play games or something like that. and come back and do it later, clean it up later. So in terms of owning my feelings when a situation happens, that seems to be, have been able to clarify to the kids, been able to clarify to Dale, and the real trick is now I was able to clarify to mom.
Just very quickly, to differentiate between these two, because we tend to lump them together, and we tend at times to believe that the Christian faith or the Christian orientation says that they're all bad. Anger is an emotion. It is a God-given system in your body that mobilizes your body to deal with an issue, to deal with something blocking you, to deal with something you care about. Anger is a very valuable emotion in a relationship because when something gets in the way, you have a system that begins to mobilize your feelings to deal with what blocks the relationship. So a caring relationship is going to have some anger in it very likely. That's a point that learning to command. And what it says is, I really care enough to want to get through the block to relate to you. Hostility is based on fear that I am being discounted or destroyed, and therefore I need to get rid of you, or trim you down the side. And hostility then leads to trying to cut the other person down. It's actually not an emotion. It actually is a way, a stance, is an attitude. I need to cut you down the side, so I will call you names, or I will find your, you know, your button that I know I can push and trim you away. And then hatred is when that becomes kind of solidified. I hate you, or I hate all so-and-so, or I hate, I can't trust any man, or, that kind of hatred. It's a stance as over against something. And that stance then involves a whole kind of tension. And some of that feeling to it. So the problem with it, and the reason I think God doesn't want us to do it, is because it eats us up inside. Hostility destroys relationships, and hatred eats us up on our inside. And anger, however, when it is expressed or shared, moves through us. It vitalizes, it energizes, it keeps us alive and awake. And it's a very useful emotion. So the idea of being angry and be not sin, I think, means share what you're feeling, but don't go on to hostility.
I'm going to have to get that for you, I know. There are a variety of ways of dealing with problem solving. We talked about the Vesuvius. Now that's really handy if you come home and you've had a rough day at work. No matter male or female, roommate or whoever, if you come home and you've got a, you come home with that kind of thing, then you might ask your partner and say, I really want to get this out of my system. Can I have 5 minutes? Will you just let me go? Fine, go right ahead. And just, that secretary, blah, 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 or that boss, social, and on the, and the other person just says, doesn't have to paraphrase, doesn't have to repeat anything back, but just get to it. Hey, I'm willing to stay with you while you get rid of that tension, which is really what it is. And doesn't have to solve the problem. I know when Dale used to come home, when I was full-time housewife, home of kids and stuff, like, Dale would come home and he had a rough day upstairs and was angry about something, and he'd give the Vesuvius, or the Mount St. Helens, I guess would be the more local name on it. We didn't know a name for it at that time. I kept feeling that I had to solve it. I'd have to figure out how to do it. I really didn't have to. All he wanted to do was get rid of the tension. Once the tension was there, he could think it through clearly himself. It's a pathway to solve himself. Somehow I had to feel responsible to solve it. So one of the neat things about saying I want to get something off my chest, you don't have to do anything, just listen, is that all you have to do is listen, you don't have to solve the problem. He'd do the same thing if I had it with the kids or the PTA or whatever it is, or now in business. Because I've been at a place in real estate for 9 years. I have my Vesuvius. I come home too. And he doesn't have to try to make it better. He doesn't have to try to patch it up or give me alternatives or anything like that. So there's a certain trust that once that tension is gone, once I finally admit it and gotten rid of, exploded, let the anger out, I can deal with it. And I think that that's a really valid point. It's kind of one of the ways you share the frustrations of somebody else's business without having to solve the problem for them. And to know that is, and to trust that, is a really intimate kind of relationship. Hey, I know if I explode this right now and let you know what's been happening and how I feel in this particular instance, I know that you won't worry about it. You won't try to solve the problem. You know I can deal with it myself. George Bach, in his book *The Intimate Enemy*, gives some other very good rituals. Creative problem solving, kind of brainstorming. And, together in a relationship, how are we going to deal with this? I've got a real problem with the way, I've got a real problem with the way our house is looking. I'm working 9 hours a day, you're working 9 hours a day, and you've got certain jobs you do, and I've got certain jobs I do, but I don't really think you're doing my old job the way I would really like them to be done. And so forth. So, how am I going to solve these problems? How am I going to, I would like to have some help from you in dealing with what I consider to be my problem. So we can get some creative brainstorming. But as I say, I don't have time to go into all of those. But for those of you who are moving into an intimate relationship, and I know we have some many engaged people in the group, if you are, if you've been having trouble dealing with this in an old established relationship, the commitment is one many people do make. And those are the ones that often end up in the divorce or in the dissolution process. Because there, the content is the primary focus, the form of the relationship becomes second. The goal is to balance, kind of the old law, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth.
That's the people who often say, we will be married as long as it goes well. And in a sense, they have to decide every morning when they get up whether they're married, whether it's going well enough to be married. And that's the rest of it.
Sometimes that's not explicit. Most people, I think, when they go into a marriage, think in terms of a longer range. And yet, perhaps for many of them, unspoken is, well, I'm going to, give it my best shot, but if it doesn't go, that's always an option. It often runs in families. And it becomes a model of how you deal with conflict, or you deal with unhappiness, or you deal with kind of a dry spell. I had one client who called me, real estate client, not counseling client. I didn't operate counseling, real estate. But one client, I sold a home to him and his wife not too many years before, 2 years before, and they had an infant at the time. And he called me up to come and list his house. And so I went over, and they were getting a divorce. I talked with him a little bit, never considered any kind of counseling, never knew there was a possible way to work through a conflict in his marriage. His parents had been divorced twice, each one. He had three older brothers and sisters, all of whom had been divorced. When they ran into a block, they said, well, this is where we divorced. It was a model for them. Most of us have been fortunate enough to have good models of marriages that have kind of gone through the dry spells, through the mountain peaks, and across the plains together. All kinds of different things in the marriages. So that for most of us, divorce does not become the number one option in case of running into disagreements and conflict. My parents were divorced when I was four. They lived with grandparents who had the kind of lasting marriage, and had a certain amount of conflict in their marriage. And I can remember my grandmother saying, "Joe Thompson, you sod," and that was an old English woman. And that was her cut out. That was supposed to cut it out inside. But they worked through it, and then of course they both had a good sense of humor. they were able to get a different perspective on different arguments. And I guess when Nina would call Abigail a sod, he'd start to giggle, and then they both started. And she never knew that that was what started in the giggle. But most of us do have, as I say, the possibility of a...
So you just consider session to me, you can see that it's over in New York.
They just made a swift change. The second type of commitment I'm going to talk about is I will commit myself because I promise, and I shouldn't break a promise. And you have all probably seen some of those kind of marriages. They have stayed with the form, but it's a pretty empty content. They kind of live together, maybe parallel lives, but very little sharing of their lives. And the third type of commitment, both of those above, I would say, are law commitments. They kind of deal with the law, either the eye for eye, tooth for tooth, or I made a commitment, or made a promise, and I'm going to keep it. The third kind says it's a corporate idea. If we will commit ourselves to participate with each other in unfolding our lives, hey, who knows? Who can look 40, 50 years ahead in the future? I look to some of you who are older, who knew when you got married what was going to be ahead for you? You didn't. You could anticipate a short ways. Maybe got married during the Depression. Maybe you got married just before the war, the Korean War. You know, you looked ahead, there was a lot of uncertainty. But there was a sense of that, well, whatever comes, we're going to be able to work it out together. And when you have that kind of a commitment, that your goal is to share your life, you know, no matter what, there is a sense of goal rather than dealing with this right now. There is a way that you're looking ahead. Somebody said, and I used this the other night when we had a group talking about the man-woman relationship. But somebody said, if you want to... to figure out who you would travel with from here to Florida, overland, what qualities you would need in a partner to do that with. You've got years in which to do it, but you're going to go from here to Florida, overland. That's the kind of qualities you might think about when you do the spouse. Because you're going to have a long overland trip, and you're going to go through deserts and across high mountains, and you're going to go across the plains, and maybe an occasional lush oasis along the way. But if each day is kind of an adventure, how you're going to follow that day? The for richer, the for poorer, the for better, the for worse, the for second, the for half. You may have long pauses on the way. And that's a whole different sense of commitment than either of the other two. And what's the other two you hear a lot of?
I'm finding that I talk to people is that they're looking for a model of marriage that allows for each individual to grow and to change. Because that's the nature of today. Each individual has the option for educational growth, learning new things, doing different kinds of things, both men and women. We're not stuck in certain roles as we have been in the past. And what happens when people approach marriage, if they approach it with a sense that we will be married and you will do this and I will do this, and then the other person starts changing and doesn't fit that role, then they say, whoops, you know, this isn't the marriage I thought. So if we can start with an image of that I'm going to marry you and I'm going to relate to you as you grow and change in life, and I'm trusting that I can grow and change, and you will still relate to me. And this may make for all kinds of strange arrangements. You know, my wife may become an engineer and may need to go to Alaska and work for 6 months or a year. And, you know, weird. Maybe she needs to do that.
I haven't thought about that one.
You know, that talks to people, they're needing all kinds of flexibility in order for each person to grow and develop and change. and to then not assume certain locked-in positions. And that's then what I see in a third category, is a kind of a flexible, open process for living life, rather than setting.
Control, share.
Sure. Well, yes, and we still need to figure out how to share life. How are we really going to share our lives with each other, not just go off and do our own thing? Because that, some try that method, and then they don't have anything left.
That's the confusion I think I'm assuming, at least what I've seen in the ways of, in my emphasis on going and change and my experience to do it, but that very thing puts the tremendous stress on me that I was going to grow apart from the sound of the book. And, I don't know that, but I have that sense of, wouldn't it be nice if we could get back to with that growth and change within whatever the sense of commitment is, that can weather that, that it can allow for that. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. With the amount of things that's going on in our society right now, we all are making lots of changes to this. There's just so much, it's not even a matter of saying, I am consciously going to go and change. You know, if you're going to interact with society today, you've got to make adjustments. You have to do a certain amount of growing, a certain amount of change. How can you do that? The question, the challenge is how to do that. How can I do that? How can Dale do that? And how can we do that? And I know in our case, we have gone in different ways as I've gone into real estate, or if I was in teaching, or I moved back to teaching, as Dale's been in counseling or in therapy and stuff like that, we have chosen to take some things that we consciously do together, not just spending time, not just free time, but as I mentioned, we've been working with couples together for the last 11 years. It's a conscious choice to do that together. We share a lot of the activities, a lot of the conversation, a lot of the insights that come out of that. Not everybody has that kind of an opportunity, but I think when you have some particular families, I think it's very important to find some major way in your life that you can share. Just to avoid the...
And I think it's very important in both commitment and responsibility. And that is to be able to forgive and be able to accept forgiveness.
Very good. Thank you very much. I had that in my notes and I did not say that. I think that's very important. To be able to forgive and to accept it.
One member of the village grows and wants to change it, that's gone to the area work or become a mother and decide to stay home or whatever, that they don't take the time to work through the problems that Roe has caused. And the change grows. It's about, you have to accept that Roe for yourself either, as well as for, you know, this is my place in the world, as well as the relationship. And people don't take the time to work through that and say, well, this is it, they can't work out. They need to work through it. Purpose, take that role for themselves. You know, they don't take the time to work through it and say, okay, well, you'll work for it.
It's not something, it's not just the automatic thing, I'm now putting on another hat, therefore I'm a different person. It is a process. There are lots of connections that make a difference. And it is a time-consuming process. But a positive time-consuming process. Somehow we get the sense that we're going to save a lot of time, but that's going to be, that's the major goal. And sometimes in saving time, we lose a lot more. Whereas in taking the time to deal with the whole process, the feelings, the thoughts, the other things that go in, and if both change, that can save a lot of time in the long run.
Just something you did this summer. You called the family, we have four children, called the family together, and we sat down, and you said, this summer's going to be very heavy for me in real estate, and I've got things going also. And so let's brainstorm all the kinds of jobs that need to be done around here to keep this household going. And we just made a whole list after. And then we said, okay, now, who's willing to help out and do which thing? And we just kind of said, well, I'll take that one, and I'll pick up this one, and we'll pass this around this way, at 13 things or this thing. And we kind of charted it out and put it up in the back of a door. And we've actually had a fairly smooth summer of everyone kind of picking up the ball in different ways. Whereas if, you know, in the past, we've assumed that because you were home taking care of your kids a lot in the past, you were doing a lot of these things, and if we had just assumed you were going to do them this summer, and you started saying, I don't have time to do them, and we didn't sit down and talk about it, we had a horrendous harangue all summer about who was going to do what, and why wasn't this getting done, and et cetera. So actually, although it takes some time, it often saves a lot of effort.
Yeah, we took about 4 hours one Sunday afternoon after when three boys came home from college. The three of us that were at home all year long had a pretty good system operating. When the three boys came in from college, it wasn't a matter of helping me out or helping Dale out. It was a matter that we are all going to be living here. And how can we get these things done that are mainly maintenance? And I Paul just came in today on the boat up the bus. He'll be here with us for these last 5 days. He's the best cook in the family. Everybody was happy when it was just 2 weeks to cook.
And shuttered when it was mine.
Okay.
Something you touched on, and I really didn't understand the meaning of it, since the uniforms got amazing to make that and everything that you said, is that you mentioned that most of us were lucky to have had some good knowledge. And something that bothers me when I'm doing this is that most of our children now don't have that. And there's a little bit out there, you think of what are their impressions, what are their models, what are they learning about their future commitment. And I hear in the top things like, which is all tied into the growth and the change, and that, well, now I feel like doing it today, or a real lack of sense of commitment to anything, to schoolwork, to anything, because of a freedom of choice, of a freedom of growth, of a freedom of change, of a freedom of really being here, because of what comes out of it. But it's like they don't understand at that age, or have the same perception. And in terms of commitment, in terms of relationships, and in terms of, like my son is 11, I'm a single parent, and just in terms of dating, what kinds of modeling is in there? And if I date somebody for 3 months and that doesn't turn into anything, and date somebody else for 3 months, you know, what's that picture for them? And yet, it's a space I have to deal with that I've never had to deal with before. And it's something that I would really like to hear more of your thoughts about as far as what kind of, I feel like there's some way that I have got to provide some kind of firm structure or value belief or something, even though the model isn't there right now. And I, you know, it feels a little scary.
Yeah, I can really feel a little shaky there. I don't have an answer for you right now. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about it. But I do know that if kids are given information, because it sounds like, hey, if you date somebody for a few months and then you say, hey, that's not going anywhere, or to be able to deal with that honestly with the child.
I suppose my sense of fear is not so much my ability to give them my own personal stuff, because I think we do a lot of that. But just like in the last 2 years, it's like it's everywhere. I mean, they're not just the only kids with single parents. And the attitude is just, I mean, to hear them talk about their other parents, you know, oh, so-and-so stayed there, oh, so-and-so, oh, they stood up, oh, I mean, it's like, it's just this lighthearted matter, you know.
Part of the talk I hear is the idea that being married is being less frugal. And what I like to correct for people is that when you're married, you're free to have some things. And when you're single, you're free to have other things. And both are different kinds of freedom. One is just the lack of freedom. If you can't have some things you haven't married, if you're not married. And so you're not free to have another single thing. Any other note, and that is that we have tremendous changes in our society going on right now. in terms of roles, in terms of way we live our lives, as a whole major shift in the woman's role in society is affecting us. And so what we're saying is that there are just many more freedoms. And because of that, there's much more instability because we often don't know how to deal with the freedoms. Now some say, therefore, let's cut back the freedoms and expect people to live a certain way. But another alternative is to realize that we can learn how to deal with these freedoms constructively and build constructively. And I think that's what we're in the process of doing. We're learning new skills. What we're talking about here, I never saw my parents really negotiate things. I hardly ever heard them have a difference of opinion. It just seemed like things were decided automatically. And so a lot of the skills that we need today, the skills for intimacy, the skills for negotiation and confrontation, a sense of what commitment is about, takes some learning and some developing in order to really make it, but I think we can. And at the same time, I am very empathetic with the struggles that people are having as they try to work out their man and woman relationship, because it is a tremendous challenge today to all of us. And a challenge to us, I think, as Christians, to draw on the deepest sense of our Christian understanding, to see the resources that are available to us to understand how we can relate in a more deeper, profound way, and build the kind of commitment that can weather these dramatic storms. So let's end on that note. Bell ring in about 10 minutes. And thank you.